Thank you for tuning in to the Head Game Podcast, powered by Mindful Athlete Training, where you grab an inside look into the heads and minds of the high performer. Learn what they do and how they think to help you take control of your own head game.
On the Head Game Podcast today, we have David Curtis, an American swimmer who is a three-time USA swimming national team member. Recently, he represented the United States against Australia at the Duel in the Pool event. A tier-sponsored athlete, Curtis now sets his sights on his first ever world championships. As a student athlete at NC State, he competes in the 50-meter free as well as the 100-meter free. Today we discuss the head game needed to compete against the best in the world. Please welcome David Curtis.
So, David, I noticed that you're wearing the hoodie. I can't make out of it completely, but is it a tier hoodie with the flag on? Is it the USA tier hoodie?
Yeah, this is my warm-up from tier that I usually wear at meets or, before events or on the podium.
All right. And when you think about tier, that's a relationship that's been, I guess, relatively new for you. Talk to us a little bit about that.
I've actually had a relationship, not directly in terms of sponsorship, but I've had a relationship with tier for years. Like, that used to be my primary suit of choice when I used to race as a kid, but only until recently we started working together on a more partnership level. Of October of last year, we started working together, and they brought me onto their elite roster of athletes so that I could have suit support and have a more baseline of support as an athlete, which has been proved to be super, super helpful.
The elite roster of athletes. Now, when I hear you say that, first of all, I kind of get like hairs like stick up on my hand, because I just think that that's just really cool to say, the elite roster. So many athletes in today's world, David, imagine, dream about, aspire to an elite status. And here you are at the young, tender age of 20, no longer a teenager, that you've been identified as elite status. Talk to us about what that journey has been like for you and how your goals, your aspirations to be elite are now really at the base of your feet at a very, very young age.
Honestly, the journey hasn't quite been as insane as you thought, as you think. It's just been more a slow progression of me getting better in the pool and just things kind of happening off of that. Like, I train a lot to be like other people. Like, I always see these high level athletes and I'm like, man, I really want to be like that. So my goals are set kind of at a high ceiling, and I just keep trying to jump and grab onto that high ceiling goal. It's been a while, but I've hit that goal, definitely, of being on the top level of athletes. And my goal right now is to just maintain that and then get ready for the Olympics in 2024.
What are some of the athletes, David, that you've aspired to?
I have always looked up to the national team and athletes on the national team, like seeing success from people like Carson Foster, who's just an insane swimmer in the IMs and backstroke and fly. And then just looking at these athletes that have such high levels of success also at a young age. But I mean, my main inspiration as a kid was always Colin Jones. He's an African-American athlete that the Olympics and has medals there. I've always aspired to be like him and achieve the levels that he has. So there's always in the back of my mind is kind of being on the level. He's also a 50 freestyler, so I'm sure that has influenced a little bit of what I choose to do. But, looking up to him and having kind of somebody to aspire to be has definitely helped, like, motivation in training and, keeping myself on track.
Was that something that just was natural, like identifying somebody and seeing what their traits were? Were you being intentional with that of, oh, that's something they're in the same category in which I'm trying to swim? their feats, their behaviors? Is that something that you were aspiring to when you were seeing it? Or was it just like, I can see myself connecting with that? Was there intention behind it or just natural?
I've always been a person that tries to find motivation in wanting to be or be some person. Like as a kid, when I was on THY back in Pennsylvania, that it wasn't necessarily focused on Colin Jones. It was focused on, oh man, I forget his name, but it's my friend Jim Schmerak's brother. He was really fast at the time, and I wasn't really able to keep up with him in practice, but I knew if I kept up with him in practice that I was getting better because he was significantly older, bigger, stronger. I've always found some type of model or role model, whether it be at the smallest level of somebody in practice or Colin Jones being an Olympian. It's been a natural path for me to find that person, kind of focus on what they do and try to match and then hopefully beat what they've done to help me reach, you know, my ladder.
And it's just not that you're just looking at them of what they're doing. It's how can I beat them? So you're kind of almost setting benchmarks along your journey. Is that kind of just your style? Is that, you know, what you're edging for? Is that something that drives you?
Yes. I definitely like finding people that are faster than me because I set them as the benchmark for, you know, where I want to be. My motivation comes out of focusing on somebody that I can try to work to beat every day. Like it's best for me when I have an enemy to focus on in practice. Like right now, that enemy is Jordan Crooks from Tennessee. He beat me in the dual meet against Tennessee, but my goal is just to try to be at the same level that he is at, as opposed to long course. I don't necessarily have a long course enemy, but my enemy is getting above that threshold of just making the world championships and getting to the Olympics. So it's more finding a level or a person that it has a high level of success or is at a certain pinnacle that I want to reach and then trying to beat that. It's motivating every day.
What's that story like when you kind of set that somebody who is a bar and then you finally beat them? Like, is there a story? Is there a moment where you've like had that? And what was that like?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on a podcast, but it's kind of like an oh shit moment. And it's kind of like a...
You can say whatever you want, David.
It's kind of like a, oh, wow, okay, well, that happened. I just kind of stand there. This happened actually my senior year of high school and I beat the American record for the high school 50 freestyle. I didn't
shout out to
think
the
it was
going to
happen that day. Yep. Shout out to Coach Ward. I didn't really think it was going to happen, especially in that moment. Like it wasn't a moment where in that race I was like, I've got it. I saw the time and I was just like, well, I've wanted this and now it's here. And wow, it's an overwhelming feeling, but I don't like to linger on it too much because then I need to find another benchmark to set. Because if I get caught up in that one moment, then I'm not going to progress. Yes, I'm going to enjoy it because, I mean, doing something that you've always wanted to do is good. It's a good feeling. But in terms of like where to move on from there, I like to celebrate and then think about, okay, what's the next step? So my next step after that meet was I want to go under 19 in college and I want to win the ACC championship and do well at NCAAs. I fell short of one of those things, but now this year is success on the international conference and NCAA level by, you know, achieving small goals every day.
How do you know when it's time to make that shift of celebration of your success and to shift into, okay, let's rev it up, new gear, now there's a new challenge ahead? What's your process like to make that shift? Like, when do you know it's the right time?
I feel that I'm just going to give a little prequel to this. Swimming is a very rewarding sport when you put in the effort and then it pays off. So I allow myself, it could be a couple days, it's just until I need to sit down and reassess what my next goals are. Like, say I have a week, like, I'm able to take a deep breath and be like, all right, I've done this, let's take a second to celebrate, relax, and then reassess. So it could vary depending on, you know, the situation or how I feel. Like, for the American record, I took about, like, 2 days, and I didn't swim. I just kind of relaxed, gave myself a mental break. And then I sat down with my coaches and tried to assess what the next step was to improve from that point. But I don't, there's no real set amount of time. It's just more dependent on my situation.
Yeah, so the situational cues. And, you know, we've talked, you know, a little bit off air too of your the satisfaction for you, or more so the never satisfied mentality of kind of always seeking out that next gear. Is that traditional with most swimmers, or is that just a unique few of people who engage in that mindset?
I feel like some of the best athletes never really settle. I mean, you can have a fantastic swim, do amazing things, but the best athletes are the ones that get back up after that success and say, I want more. I mean, you never saw Michael Phelps break a world record and be like, oh, okay, I'm done. He's like, I want to break again. And I want to break this one as well. And I want to break this one as well. And he did that. So, I mean, yes, I don't discredit celebrating your successes, but I do emphasize the point, at least for me, that you could have the time to celebrate your successes, but there's more. There's always more that you can do, or more that you can try to do to either make that success better or achieve different goals and get to a different benchmark.
David, that mindset that you're speaking of there's always more. I was a football player, so I tend to gravitate to Super Bowls. And you often hear the people, when they win them, that first time, it's very exciting. They've reached the pinnacle of their team journey. But then they say they're even that much more motivated to get back there again. And that sounds very much like what you're saying, is there's always more. My question is, talk to us about the grit that is required in all those days, weeks, months, hours, thousands of hours in between the more that really requires that extra something from you. What's the game that you're playing with yourself in your mind, that head game of how do I stick with there's always more?
I'm going to be completely honest. I can talk about how there's always more and that I stay motivated, but there's days that I get up and there's just no motivation there. It's about reminding myself what exactly I'm working for. And by doing that, I play kind of a game in my brain of setting small and short-term goals and then long-term goals, so that I always have some type of objective whenever I go into practice and work hard. So like small objective goals could be meet a specific time in practice or work on a specific technique. Because inevitably, the point where I get in a mental area where there's not motivation is when I don't have goals and things to think about and people to beat. So the game for me mentally is sitting down and either writing on paper or typing down specific objectives that I want to achieve in every single practice and weeks and months and meets to go to. And then long-term goals like the Olympics or the World Championships, which I am lucky to say that I've gotten to this month. But it's for me, it's more focusing on after that success is reassessing, okay, what do I want now? I know there's more that I can do, but how am I going to get there? By making short-term goals, medium-term goals, and long-term goals.
Yeah, that's awesome. And then being able to break those down are critical, right? Because they're giving you difficult but achievable steps along the way to just reinforce the pattern. There's a sport, CrossFit, right? It's a way of exercising, and they have the CrossFit Games. And there's a woman, she's from Iceland, two-time CrossFit champion, Annie Thor's daughter, and she talks about how she doesn't believe in motivation. Now, this is somebody who has to be in the gym every single day in order to beat her craft. And again, the most fittest woman on earth two times in a row, you know, and she doesn't believe in motivation. I find that as an interesting concept. You know, when I say don't believe in motivation, what does that get you thinking about? If you don't need motivation, what do you need?
Honestly, you just need to be mentally tough, I believe, if you don't have motivation. I don't agree with that point at all, at least for me. I'm sure there's different situations with different people, but for me, I need something to work for in order for that that grit and that mentality to be there. For some people, yes, you can go to the gym and work out and build muscle, and then you're just doing it to go through the motions. But I feel like motivation is an added kind of component that is necessary for you to truly reach your full potential? Because, I mean, if you don't consider all of the points of, like, all the different points that could get you to your peak of success, like, I don't know how to explain it, but I feel like it's just, it's motivation and, like, grit and all of that is, in my eyes, mandatory for you to be able to, you know, reach full potential. Because, I mean, if you're not considering all angles and trying all things, then you could just be cutting yourself short.
Yeah, what I'm hearing, though, you also talking about is saying when on those days you aren't motivated necessarily, you're finding ways to engage in task orientation or things that you can actually do to kind of make it happen. Her point was really, you know, when you need motivation to get up and go to the gym or work out, you know, that means on the days that you don't have motivation, you may not go, right? You give yourself an out. She really was talking about discipline was the key element. And I think that's something that you have, is this discipline to, even when motivation is low, to identify those steps to kind of put it into practice, which then as a result of that, you do find motivation, right? Almost through that discipline, the motivation then becomes versus kind of needing that motivation and that desire.
Now, if you ask Braden, my discipline on some of those days may not be the most fantastic. So I don't know if Braden would totally agree with me having maximum discipline on those days, but I try my best to stay on task, because when I'm lacking motivation, I go back to the controllable factors that I can do, like making sure that I'm doing certain things in practice with my technique or focusing on keeping myself strong throughout a specific race. By having these like goals, it works kind of two ways. One, it gives you motivation because you want to meet those goals, but then also it's more on the small term goals side, because those are more things you can do every day, like eating properly or sleeping properly or doing good things in practice. It keeps me on track because I'm able to refer back to those when there's no motivation there. And then it helps build motivation again, because I'm like, well, if I stick with this, I'm going to get better. Getting sleep is important, so I'll feel better tomorrow. And it kind of helps me get back on track.
David, just before we came on, we were talking about, you know, you're going back to Australia. You had great success there with the duel in the pool. Congratulations to that. But now you're headed back there for the World Championships. And you mentioned that your flight is 21 hours. The longest flight that I've ever been on is about 12. So one of the things that, you know, often really tugs at high performers is the role that mental fatigue can play. That exhaustion between the ears, the worn down capacity to just tolerate more. Talk to us a little bit about how you address that when you're traveling on literally the other side of the world.
I will admit it's not as great as you might think it would be, but I do have certain things that keep me sharp and also keep me moving to the point where I can try to minimize the amount of mental fatigue that I have. And one of those is making sure my body's in check. So I will make sure that I have food on me that keeps me not awake, but, you know, keeps me feeling healthy and not achy. Because, well, those long flights are, they're tough, especially on your body. And USA Swimming does a great job with providing compression and different types of equipment to assist you on those flights so that your body is in check, which also helps my mind stay in the same spot as well. But I mean, between listening to music, relaxing, I did your breathing activities and your, you know how you, the expanding where you look at something small and then expand out. I did that on the flight as well, and it helped me relax and keep me in a good mental space. And then just watching TV and just trying to stay relaxed and kind of in a nice, calm mental zone definitely helps reduce the amount of mental fatigue that I have. Because if I exit that, that's when I start to get tired and either start to think negatively, like, oh man, I'm going to Australia, I'm going to this meet, am I supposed to be here, blah, 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 blah. For me, mental fatigue happens a lot from negative self-talk. So trying to distract myself and keep my body in shape while also either distracting or maintaining a good mental, like, calm zone is the best way to help, for me at least, reduce mental fatigue.
What do you find is that mindset shift maybe in, unless it's the same between maybe when you're at NC State compared to kind of competing overseas internationally against professionals who have been doing it who are in their, you know, even their 30s, you know, is there a mental shift when you're facing maybe, you know, I know last year in terms of the Olympic trials, like going against the fastest man to ever touch water, right? Caleb Dressel, like, is there a different mental shift that you have versus NC State versus internationally?
There was previously, but I'm working to attempt to make that shift the same. I would go to these, I'm not going to say higher level meets, because I truly believe NCAAs is the most competitive meet in the world over the Olympics. It is the most scary meet in the world. I will let you guys know that. But I had this idea, mental shift of, I'm at the Olympic trials. This is it, the Olympics. I didn't quite simplify it. I made it and I blew it out of proportion, which started to promote negative thinking, hyperventilation, sweating, anxiety. But I'm trying to make every single meet that I go to almost like a dual meet or a pro series. A pro series is, I wouldn't say a lower level meet, but it's definitely not, you know, nationals or NCAAs. But going in with the mentality, I'm doing it right now, and it's given me extreme success by going to a meet thinking of it like a pro series or just kind of a less stressful meet, and not making the mental shift of it's the Olympic trials, this is it, helps me reduce the amount of stress that I feel in the meet. Like I did it with the Tennessee meet. It's just a dual meet. I'm swimming against one of the fastest men in the country, but I'm here to swim, execute my details, focus on what I need to do to make my levels of success better and for my team. And by simplifying it down to it's just another meet helps me, you know, enter a zone of more calm activity and just relax and helps me swim better.
David, for all of those high school swimmers out there that aspire to get to college, just, I got to backtrack. Talk to us a little bit about what you mean by the scariest meet is the NCAAs.
There are the fastest athletes in the country at that meet. And it is a very, making that meet is incredibly difficult because it's a very slim amount of spots that are there. So if you're going to NCAAs, you're swimming against the fastest national and international athletes in the world for short course yards. So in essence, I truly believe it's like the Olympics for short course yards. The intensity there is just out of this world. I mean, everyone's there to swim fast and everyone's there to win. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily cutthroat, but it's that you're definitely intimidated by the aura inside of that pool because everyone's just tense. They're like, man, there's a lot of fast people here. And you're just kind of stuck. I wouldn't say stuck, but you're just kind of in an area where it's just like, wow, this is just, it's just insane. For me, it's the scariest because I tend to get into my head about seeing people like Bjorn Seeliger, who swims for Cal, super fast, 50-100 freestyler, and Brooks Curry, who's also an extremely fast 50 freestyler. You're seeing all these names that you see in the newspaper and in magazines, and you're like, wow, he's actually here, and I'm racing next to him. So there's that level of fear that you're out of place and in an environment where, again, everyone is incredibly fast. So, I think that's what makes it the scariest and most competitive meet on Earth, is not only are the fastest athletes on the planet there, but you're also going to be separated by 0.05 to make the final. Like, you have to be on your A game every single race you have. Because if you're off by 0.03, you're not making the A final. You're not making the B final. You're done.
Do you recognize that you're also one of those people too when you're there? That you are one of those fastest people, that people are maybe looking at you and saying, oh shit, there's David Curtis?
I don't necessarily think like that very much. I don't actually think about that too much. I'm not even sure. I doubt that, but maybe. I'm not quite sure. I don't really think too much about what people perceive of me. Yeah, no. I don't necessarily think too heavily about what people perceive of me because I'm too focused on
it. Yeah, I guess it's less more so about how maybe others perceive you, but I think you're looking around the room of look at all these fast people, but you're there. You're in that room. You've competed at high levels. People know you. right, in that capacity. And I think it's important to recognize that. And I know that's not what your mentality is, right? You're like, I can always go faster. I can always go faster. But I think that's always important too, to recognize, like, you know, being in the room, right? Being in that space, enjoying when you're at Worlds, right? Enjoying when you get to travel to Australia as part of that journey for yourself. Doesn't mean that you can't have that kind of killer mentality. Still, there's fast people. I'm going to go out and do my best. But I think it's important every once in a while to soak it in just to bring yourself down.
Yeah. I've always kind of been the guy that comes out of nowhere from fourth, third, second place, and kind of the underdog. And I'm starting to enter an area where I'm not necessarily as much of an underdog anymore. Obviously, at the world stage, I'm not quite at the level that most people are at. But for these other meets, it's hard to realize that. I mean, I am sometimes seated first, and I'm at the top of the list there, and it's just hard to realize that sometimes. I'm so used to being like, I'm in fourth place, I want to win, or there's this huge swimmer that I really want to beat, I want to get in front of him. And being at the top, it's a more scary place to be, in my opinion, because instead of being like, I have nothing to lose, I'm in fourth, I want to get first, you're at first and you're like, oh, I need to hold my place because I am at the top. And there's other people that are hunting me down. I prefer to be on the hunt rather than be hunted.
David, when I hear you talk about that mentality and you talk about being an underdog, I have to do it because I hearken back to when the Eagles won the Super Bowl and Kelce is, they're celebrating the center, the starting center for the Philadelphia Eagles is on the Art Museum steps. And he tells this story about how their offensive line coach above their meeting room had a slogan. It had a sign. And in my best Kelce impression, he says, "Hungry dogs run faster." And when you said to me that you are that underdog and you'd like to come from fourth, talk to us about your hunger. Talk to us about what you're chasing, per se.
I am a very big person on getting first. I think first, anything but first is losing. I know that's not necessarily a fantastic mentality to have, but it's motivation for me so that, I mean, the best of my game is most likely going to be beating the best. And the only way that I'm going to achieve my maximum success for myself is becoming the best, because if I get first, then I'm probably going pretty fast. Being on the hunt for me and being an underdog is more motivating than being like first and holding it, because there's always this thing my parents say when they see me swim is called like afterburners or turbos at the end of my race. It usually happens when I'm behind, because I see that person and I have a fire that I'm like, oh, I really don't feel like losing right now. And the motivation there in being second, being behind, gives me an extra level of energy, almost. Like it's an untapped energy bank that I have inside of me that allows me to push myself and try to go past what I thought was physically possible to get first. Because, I mean, again, getting first is pretty fun. And usually if you get first, then there's some level of success there. But that bank of energy is harder to tap into when you're already first and you're defending your spot, because I feel more scared that that position is going to be compromised if I don't do what I'm supposed to do. It's a different approach to racing.
So again, that's the interesting head game, right, that you're playing there of, I don't want to be too far behind, but I know when I'm behind, I'll go actually faster. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie or even the story about Secretariat. One of the most dominant racehorses of all time, right? Winning the Triple Crown. But in the first race, he always starts from behind, right? He's the fastest two-year-old. And then he always starts from behind. But then in the final race of the Triple Crown, he decides to go out first and just kind of runs his race and just gives it his all and, you know, has the largest margin of victory. I think it's like over 32 lengths and wins. And I think it's an interesting head game of where you want to play. Do I want to be up front? Because that naturally is going to bring pressure. And then from behind, I can bring the pressure myself. And going with that back and forth, do you ever see yourself at that front? Do you ever see yourself wanting to be at that front, wanting that target on your back?
I do. A lot of things the NCAA is, success happens in the morning. So the higher you're placed, the better you're going to be seated and the better opportunities you have to get points. So I'm learning kind of the mentality of you are going all out in the morning, you're going to get as high as you can, and you're going to try your best so that you can get the best seating possible. And I've kind of brought that into national competition as well. Kind of having the mentality of going out to be first and holding that spot. And it's worked. There's six, some of my best successes are actually in the morning with that mentality of I want to be first going into tonight's finals. Like that's actually what happened at the Pro Series in California. I tied for the 11th fastest time in American history in prelims, not in finals, because my mentality there was I want to be first. I want to be on top of that podium. I also wanted to hear my intro music because you usually get to choose the song when you guys are walking out. That's kind of fun. But it's the mentality right now for me is going out to be first and holding that spot. And I felt with the combination of like decompressing the meat of not actually what it is, like Olympic trials, like that's just, it's just another meet. Like using that in coordination with I want to be first, I want to try my best and do the best that I can to get the highest that I can has created a lot of success in terms of, you know, being more mentally stable before a race and relaxed and easygoing.
David, when I listened to you talk and you mentioned Michael Phelps earlier, everyone knows who follows swimming, even high performance sports, how he's made comments in the past where he's spent consecutive number of days in the pool training. I think it's some insane number of days without taking a day off. And so often in today's world, especially with younger athletes, the notion of recovery or to take time off is being suggested as more of that equal balance, that holistic gain for the athletes. Share with us your training regimens, your practices, your ideology about days in the pool, days off. What works for you?
In terms of what I do currently, this is separate from my ideology, is I practice twice on Monday, once on the evening and on Tuesday, once on Wednesday, once on Thursday, and then twice on Friday. Braden has me resting a lot of the time. There's a group of super sprinters, people that are more focused on the shorter distance of races that have more rest than others. Like some people are doubling on Monday, Tuesday, and Friday, as opposed to just Monday and Friday. The ideology here at NC State is that you are going to get rest and you need the rest to be at your highest level. Because if I'm just practicing nonstop, back to back to back to back to back, the quality of that practices that you're at is going to be compromised just because you're doing quantity. And a lot of things at NC State here is they for one, they want a quality practice as opposed to having a quantity, a certain quantity of practices. Because for me, this also aligns with what I believe is if you practice 20 times in a week and all those 20 practices are mediocre, as opposed to practicing 15 times and having 12 of those practices be absolutely fantastic, and three of those be recovery. I feel like you're getting more out of having a quality practice as opposed to focusing on the quantity of the practices that you're having. I'm a big fan of like self-care and self-preservation and making sure your body and mind are on the right spot to compete and be successful. Like if I need a day off, obviously I can't do this really that much here at NC State. My schedule is managed, but like over the summer, if I need a day off, I'm going to take it because I'm going to come back stronger the next day. I don't believe in extended breaks. Like, say, I'm not going to take like a week off, but if I need a morning off, then I'm going to take it because getting that extra sleep and recentering yourself for that next practice, I believe, is more important than forcing yourself to go to that practice and then having a subpar or bad practice. Because, I mean, keeping yourself mentally stable and physically stable is important because if you don't do that in practice, then it's not going to correlate to a meet. And if you focus on keeping yourself in the highest level physical and mental ability possible while you're practicing, you're not only going to get better in practice, but you're also going to improve in meets because what you practice outside of a meet, it eventually comes out in a meet.
I'm hearing a lot of though intention with it, and I think a lot of high performers. Well, a lot of people think that you can't take rest because they do hear the stories of like a Michael Phelps, right? And they believe that they shouldn't be taking rest. Like they just need to constantly go, go, go. And then most people, we know this, aren't Michael Phelps, right? As well as that can lead to a lot of burnout, right? So learning how to strain, right? Challenge yourself, push your boundaries, but then add proper recovery with intention. I think that's where most people, as well as a lot of high performers, recognize that like growth, it's active recovery versus a passive recovery, right? There's more of a focus and intent behind it versus, you know, you're not taking a day off just to take a day off. You're taking a day off so that you can recover, recharge, to go back in, to kind of lean back into your challenge versus I'm removing myself from it because I'm worried or concerned about it. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's accurate. Yeah.
David, I got to ask, Super Swimmers, love the name. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Super Sprinters.
Oh, Super Sprinters.
Yeah, they're just the people that are focused. That's me. That's primarily just me. They're more focused on the shorter distance races, so 50s and 100s. Of either freestyle or stroke, like relay focused, like people that are just more like the short distance. Because you can be a sprinter and expand into 100 and 200 freestyle range or 100 and 200 stroke. I feel like the super sprinters are more 50 and 100 focused as opposed to having more versatility. I'm not very versatile when it comes to the NCAA. My forte is the 50 freestyle, and I'm working on actually currently expanding into the 100 freestyle and 200 freestyle as we speak. But I would definitely say I'm more of a 50 swimmer.
David, when is that determined as a swimmer? You know, you're talking about distance here. We know about your records. We know about how the 50 has really become ingrained in your swimming DNA. When I think about competition, I go right to the sprinter as a runner versus the marathon runner. And there's all types of research about those who are more comfortable with delayed gratification are going to be able to go farther, endure longer, and maintain that discipline, yet that patience that so often is required for a longer race. When did you know the 50 was home for you?
I've always been more of a short distance race type of person. It started out with backstroke. It kind of went a little bit into fly, but I realized as I was getting into high school and working with Ward that I enjoyed the fine tuning mechanics of the 50 freestyle and kind of the perfectionist part of the 50 freestyle. Because at some level, you have to be a perfectionist in the 50 freestyle. Because you got to nail all the details every single time. And if you miss, say, a little bit of a turn on a 500, you can make that up by kicking a little bit more on that next lap and nailing the next turn. But on the 50 freestyle, you have two laps and that is it. And you have to nail every single detail every single time. And it's kind of addicting to me on a level of you're always focused on excellence in that race. And it's short, so it's easier. So I don't know. It's just a level of a feeling like perfectionist kind of mentality of, you know, trying to nail the details every single time on the race. It's a different level of excitement as opposed to like swimming a 500 freestyle.
The phrase that you just kind of took out of my frontal lobe was attention to detail laden, right? When you're talking about this perfection within the 50, it's short burst, it's time limited, it's you're executing on attention, focus, concentration, your mind and your body in total, you know, unison. Talk to us a little bit more about your approach mentally, that game that you entertain yourself with in approaching the block. When you get on the block, your explosiveness into the water through the other end of the pool.
I wasn't aware that it was becoming a thing. I'm just going to go back a little bit. When I put my foot up on the block, apparently that's like my thing now. People are correlating that with me. That's actually just me trying to relax my heart rate and breathing. When I'm up there, I'm just deep breathing. But from that point where I put my foot on the block, it is all an automated sequence of motions and muscle memory. All of the practice for the 50 freestyle happens in the practice pool. I don't overanalyze anything after I put my foot up on that block. My mentality going in is I've done this a million times, so I'm just going to let my body do what it's trained to do and what I've worked on, and that's that. Because when I start to think critically in the 50 freestyle, like I need to take this certain amount of kicks, I need to do this or that. I disconnect from that energy bank of pure speed and reaction time and energy that is required in the 50 freestyle to go fast time, because then I'm focusing more on stuff that I've already practiced a million times. So it's, for me, it's practice in the practice pool of details, 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 attention to detail, stroke rate, kicks, explosiveness off the block. And then when I put my foot up on that block for the race itself, it's let your body do what it knows what to do. Because at that point, I'm in the pool for 20 to 24 hours a week. So it's muscle memory. Like I'm not going to be changing anything prior to the race or during the race. Whereas in the distance races, you're constantly adapting to waves that are coming in your lane, drafting, different types of turns, your pull rate, you're speeding up and speeding down throughout the race. From the 50 freestyle, it's just a go race. And by disconnecting from thought and, yeah, just basically just allowing my body to do what it's trained to do when I put my foot up on that block is what happens. That's a lot of my best races, I don't really remember. I don't really know. I have to watch the video review usually to see what happened, because, again, I'm in a full, complete mental disconnect because my body just completely takes over. And yeah, that's how I know it's a good race, is when I don't really remember what happened during it.
I always enjoy, you know, talking with people who are high level in their craft, because they tend to have a perspective maybe that the average person doesn't. You know, so if I'm just a casual watcher of swimming or anything, right, I'm seeing people just swim in the water, right, move as fast, kick their legs and pull. And it's kind of like watching like an expert chess match. It's like, well, I've played chess before, like I get it. But there's a whole nother level of thinking. There's some insight that master chess level players have. What is that for you and your role in as a swimmer? Like, is there a nuance or something, that a way in which you might approach something that maybe the average person wouldn't even know to think about, in terms of even the 50 free being as short as it is? Like, is there something that people are just missing by watching? And if they knew it, you know, they'd have a better insight into a swimmer's mind or your mind.
I've talked to a lot of sprinters at a high level, and they all do the same thing of allowing your body to do what it's trained to do. I got a lot of questions on Instagram of like, how do I improve my 50 time? And how do I get better at not getting as nervous throughout a race? And a lot of the main question I get is, what do I think about before I get into my race? And I say, don't think about it. Think about what you're going to do in your race when you're practicing. Because a lot of people will get up on the block and be like, all right, I have to take 6 kicks. I have to take this amount of strokes in a lap. And they're using the energy that they could use in that race to analyze stuff that they've already done for hours prior to that race. So for me, my best advice to people is to just trust your training and your coaches to the level that you know what to do. Your body knows what to do because you've practiced so many hours in the pool. I mean, you have to practice in the pool to get better, obviously, and there's a lot of time input in those races. It's just disconnect from these thoughts of what you have to do and allow your body to do what it's trained for. Again, if you haven't trained, then you're probably not going to do well in swimming, because in order for you to be successful at a certain level, you have to train and do repeats and repetitively do motions, so that when you're in a race, that's just what you know what to do, and you're also stronger in those motions. But if you've done the work, just trust your training and your coaches and allow your body to do what it's trained to do instead of overthinking it, because then you're putting yourself in a position of overthinking and overanalyzing what you're about to do when you've actually already done it for so many hours prior to that race.
In practice, is there one thing that, you know, we've talked about it, you're one of the fastest finishers on earth, right? Is there one thing that you're really focusing on right now as you start to, congratulations again, to making it to Worlds? Is there one thing you're focusing on as you lead up to it?
The first 15 meters. As you said, my forte, unfortunately, in the 50 freestyle is coming from behind and finishing strong. My coaches believe that I can achieve a higher level of success if I focus on the first part of my race, because that's where I suffer. So we're focusing on initial speed and technique. We're going to be focusing more on that as we get closer to World Championships. Right now, we're working on the baseline, strength of everything. But for me personally, it's about improving the first lap of my race, because that's where I suffer. If I can come back like I normally do, then I'm going to be okay. But the point of improvement here is starting out fast and starting out first, as opposed to starting out fourth and then coming back at first. Because if I'm out first, then I'm probably going to win by a larger margin if I come back like the normal amount that I usually do. So it's all about fine-tuning and figuring out where I can improve. And right now, the weak point is that first 15 yards or 15 meters of my race.
David, often people will say it's not how you start in athletics or competition, but it's how you finish. Interestingly enough, you're comfortable with your finish and you're working on your start. Talk to us about flipping that mental script.
I disagree with that saying, because, I mean, why not just be strong the entire way through? You can finish strong, which is cool, but why not finish strong and also be body lengths ahead of that person, because you started out strong. You started out as strong as you finish. I've always been kind of the person, as I said before, to come from behind, the underdog. But as we're shifting in the mentality of being fast in prelims, being fast in the morning, you can't really be an underdog in the morning, because you could miss that opportunity, that window to be in that A final, because you're focusing on getting that, on being that underdog. And what you got to do is start out fast and end strong. I truly believe, especially for swimming, I believe this is more swimming specific, you got to be strong throughout your entire race in order to be the best. You can't always rely on finishing strong. And for me, I've lost races because I've started out slower than what I should have. I'm only now learning, specifically more for the 100-yard freestyle, that I have to start out fast. I always relied on the back half, the last 50 of my 50 freestyle, or 100 freestyle, and I wasn't really progressing in the 100 freestyle because I wasn't taking it out fast. I had fear of taking it out fast and having issues on the back 50. So what we're working on now is starting out fast, but still finishing strong. Because again, as I said before, I'd rather be out first and finish just as strong as I would normally than have to catch up ground on that back half.
You make me think of a story about Steve Prefontaine, who was a runner for the University of Oregon, competed at the Olympic level, and tragically was killed in a motor vehicle accident. But his method of operation in his distance running was to not pace himself, not have strategy, but to go out strong, hard, endure, and absolutely bury his opponents, so much so that he was sending a very resonating message that he could not be beaten. And once he found his proverbial literal stride, he did just that for quite a while. His nickname was Pre. And if you're not familiar with him, David, I highly encourage that you do a little research, because it's a fascinating story of mindset, especially in a sport that at that time so traditionally encouraged pacing and strategy. And he really flipped the script.
You give me a tingle when you said bury him. I like that. A little tingle went on, right? I like that mentality of bury him. It's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what one of my teammates does in the 50 freestyles. He's got one of the fastest first laps in the NCAA. And what he does off the start is just absolutely drop everybody. I think the level of success for me, again, is in the back 25. But if I can bury them in the first 25, but then bury them even more in the back 25, I'm going to end up a lot higher than I was if I just bury them in the back 25.
So, David, I know you're working on a lot right now. You're more than just a swimmer, right? So what are some things that maybe our audience can get behind, or if you have anything that you're working on you'd like to share in anticipation of seeing you in Worlds in December?
In terms of what I'm working on, there's nothing crazy happening with me right now, except I'm working with a couple of companies that you'll see in the future. So just keep an eye on my social media. But it's just focusing right now on brute training and academics as I go into the World Championship season. I want to be the best prepared possible for the World Championships, as this is my first international FINA debut with Team USA. So my focus right now is heavy training and focusing on making sure that I'm as ready as possible. But there should be some interesting stuff happening between now and the spring. I can't really speak on any of it right now as it's in the development with USA Swimming, but just keep an eye out with my social media and there'll be more updates that you can locate there.
Yeah, I'll put them in the links, but if you just want to say them too, where can they find you?
I'm on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. It's _ David Curtis. I believe there's 3 S's on TikTok, but you know. You could find me on those social medias, and then I've also got a website at davidcurtis.org where you can contact me directly if you have questions or any needs that I can assist you with. I'm always open to help anybody, whether it be for swimming or just any type of sport, improve. The best thing that you can do is help other people reach the level that they want. That's where I get the most satisfaction. So if you ever need anything questions wise, just feel free to contact me through any of those.
David, one last observation that I hopefully you'll be kind enough to share. You know, everyone's success story, regardless of their stage in their career, people gravitate to having a better understanding of where people come from in anticipation of where they're going. For those of our listening audience that are not aware, you know, you're from Bucks County, Pennsylvania. You attended the Pennington School, a private school in New Jersey. You're now at NC State. You're off to competing at Worlds. And I know that your horizon line has the Olympic rings slowly rising, not setting. Talk to us a little bit about that journey beginning to end and any advice that you might have, again, for our athletes that are listening about what things you bring into your craft that have helped you stay the course.
I didn't start out where I'm at right now. I didn't start out actually as a competitive swimmer. I started out at the YMCA learning how to swim. All success stories aren't textbook of starting out and being insanely good at your sport. Some people, like Alex Stevens from Pennington, started out not even swimming until high school. So what you got to do and what I did is just find a passion. Because success is going to follow you. It followed me. I think it followed me. It followed me when I started to find out exactly what I wanted to do and what I enjoyed. And that was swimming and being with teammates and swimming the 50 freestyle. I've honed down after a lot of training and a lot of time with coaches. I found out exactly what I wanted to do, and I stuck with it. So my success story, I hope, isn't over anytime soon. I'd like to talk more on that later, but for me, it was more as I learned more about myself and what I needed and my career was swimming, what I want to do with it is finding passions and things like that that helped me stay motivated and get to where I am. So just my advice for anyone that wants to achieve at a high level in anything, this can literally be anything, academics, school, sports, it just doesn't matter. It's just find the passion and run with it, because God knows where it'll take you. And it's really up to you exactly where it takes you, because you're in control of that.
Well, David, I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank you. I know that you are insanely busy, that you have a super structured schedule presently, courtesy of NC State, but also and just our work with you in the past. You are beyond your years as far as your perspective, the harnessing of that passion, the very passion that you just shared with our audience. So I thank you for that. And with certainty, young man, your future is very, very bright. And courtesy of Mindful Athlete Training, Dr. Stevens and myself, we are excited. We are very, very enthusiastic about what you're going to be doing in the future. And thank you so much for joining us on the Head Game.
Of course. Thank you for having me.